I'm Ann Nicholson Weber, and this is Talk Theater in Chicago Interview Podcast. This week, I'm talking to Sheldon Patinkin. Sheldon is the chair of the theater department at Columbia College in Chicago. He's an ensemble member with the Gift Theater and an artistic consultant, I think, with Steppenwolf.
And Second City.
And Second City. And one of Second City's founding fathers, actually. They're from pretty much the beginning.
More or less the uncle more than the father, but that's okay.
Okay. A founding uncle. I like that. Sheldon has recently published a book called No Legs, No Jokes, No Chance, which is a history of the American musical theater.
You want to know why it's called that?
Yes.
It's a little complicated. The book says that Oklahoma, the musical, is the beginning of the modern contemporary American musical. It's the Rodgers and Hammerstein format. But it's the first musical that made it clear to everybody writing musicals that the book, the script, comes first, and the music and the songs and the dances and the comedy come out of the needs of the script. It wasn't that way for the most part before then. Well, while Oklahoma was trying out in New Haven, Connecticut, before it went to New York, Billy Rose, a very well-known producer, was heard to say in the lobby during the intermission, "No tits, no jokes, no chance." Walter Winchell's secretary was in the lobby. Walter Winchell was the most powerful gossip columnist in New York. He published it in his column about Oklahoma, but he couldn't publish that, so he wrote, "No legs, no jokes, no chance." And then, of course, came in, got rave reviews, and ran for, I think, 4 years, and changed the very nature of the musical in terms of how people perceived it, how the writers of musicals perceived it, and also was the first musical to get a complete cast, complete recording with the original cast.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, maybe you could just describe for people what the book is to start.
My book?
Yeah.
Oh, it's a history of the American musical. The first chapter is about Oklahoma, but then it goes all the way back to Mozart's The Magic Flute, which is the same structure as the Rodgers and Hammerstein musical, and traces the very gradual development from The Magic Flute to Oklahoma of the musical form through American minstrel shows and burlesque and vaudeville, European operettas, and various things that happened along the way that were almost musicals but not quite, to the Broadway musical. By the 20s, there was one year, I think it was 1927, when something like 60 musicals opened on Broadway in 1 year.
Wow.
They were considerably less expensive. The 20s had money anyway. And they had an audience. Shows didn't need to run that long to pay off the original investment. Mm-hmm. Now a Broadway musical needs to run usually a good 3 years or so to just to pay off its investment at really good business.
Yeah, yeah.
And it has become, therefore, an elitist kind of form, Broadway in particular, because who else can afford it?
Mm-hmm. You talk about the golden age of the American musical, which you
It's basically from Oklahoma to Fiddler on the Roof.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And since then?
It fragmented. Fiddler on the Roof was midway through the 60s, and the 60s were insane everywhere, and Broadway didn't know what to do about it. Hair was something to do about it, but it didn't have any successors, partly because the guy who wrote Hair had two more musicals that opened, I think, 2 years after Hair, and the two together had a total of 9 performances.
Oof. Ouch.
I saw one of them. My girlfriend was in it, and she kept making me come to the previews to tell her what else to do. And I kept on saying, there's nothing
it's
you
unfixable.
Can do.
Right, right.
Collect your check.
Right.
So then Harold Prince did Cabaret. And then in 1970, he teamed up with Stephen Sondheim. Cabaret, Hair is a concept musical. It's not a story that's from beginning to end. It's about something, and everything in it illustrates that something. Mm-hmm. Hair is a concept musical. Chorus Line is a concept musical.
Right.
Cats is a concept musical. If you notice
gritting
a change,
your teeth.
Yeah, well, a change in my voice, because I think Andrew Lloyd Webber is not my favorite. Can I put it that way?
Uh-huh.
I know that many people disagree with me. Most of my students disagree with
me.
I wrote this book because there's no, it's actually a textbook.
Yeah.
There is no textbook on the history of the American musical. And when we started the musical theater major at Columbia College, I said, I'll teach a history course in it because I've been seeing musicals since the 40s. Mm-hmm. I started by Xeroxing some information and passing it out to the class.
Mm-hmm.
And I started Xeroxing more and more and more information. And then instead of doing that, I would start writing segues between the information. And then I said, why don't I just write it?
Yeah.
And I did, with no sense of wanting it published. It was for my class. Mm-hmm. But then it grew.
It's what, 500-something pages?
Small print.
Yeah.
It was longer than that, let me tell you. I think Northwestern University Press is terrific. They did a really excellent job with it. I had some trouble with my original editor, who was someone jobbed in for the job. I didn't agree with a lot of the changes that she wanted to make, or should I say made, that I had to unmake. I'll just say one thing that she did. She uncontracted all the contractions.
Uh-huh, because it seemed to her too
it's,
breezy.
It wasn't scholarly.
Right, mm-hmm. Yeah.
But my book is written in my style, not in standard style. And without that, I don't think it's as good a book.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's actually, in a subtle way, quite opinionated.
It's not very subtle sometimes.
Sometimes, that's right. That's right. An unnecessary musicalization of a good play is one phrase I remember.
I'm sure I said that more than once.
Yeah.
I say in the foreword, there are opinions in here.
Right. So it isn't meant to be simply a dry, objective
no.
history.
Although there's an enormous amount of information
yeah.
in it.
Yeah.
It took forever. I think I started it something like 12 years ago.
Well, and it ends up essentially cataloging the important shows from each season, actually, I think.
Year.
Isn't that right? Each year, yeah. And
once we hit the 20th century, it's year by year.
Yeah. And so you... I mean, it's in a way, it's a list, but each one, first of all, you chose to have there. So I imagine that there was a lot of exercise of judgment in which shows to discuss.
Well, mostly they're shows that were big hits.
Mm-hmm. I guess you talked about the hits of the time.
Or that had really great scores.
Mm-hmm. Or that in some way nudged the medium.
Yeah, that's very important, as a matter
yeah.
of fact. Thanks. And also it's... shows that are revivable.
Mm-hmm.
I'm doing with City Lit. We haven't got a date yet because Terry McCabe, who's the artistic director, doesn't want to do it in their space. It's too small.
Yeah.
So he's trying to find a space for it. It's one of the series of musicals written in the teens by called the Princess Musicals, with a score by Jerome Kern and lyrics by P.G. Woodhouse, who wrote all the G's
Fun,
books.
Yes, right.
And a book by Guy Bolton and P.G. Woodhouse. It's called Oh Boy. And it's charming.
Fun.
Yeah, and there's only one sort of hit, still sort of done, Jerome Kern song in it, but it's a really good score.
So this is undeservedly obscure.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Uh-huh.
But it's the Princess musicals were a very important part of the history of the musical, though, because the Princess was a very small theater compared to the other Broadway houses. It was, I think, 290 seats and a smaller stage and a smaller budget. So Kern and his writers knew that they had to write something that worked as a smaller musical.
Mm-hmm. Less of a spectacle.
So it's a smaller chorus. Smaller band, one set per act, and only two sets altogether.
Mm-hmm.
And all of the chorus members, because it's a smaller chorus, are individualized. And all of the principals had their turn. It isn't, and there were no stars. So in essence, they were the first ensemble musicals.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, one of the points that comes through from the book is, I mean, I think a lot of people think of the spectacularization, is that a word, of the Broadway musical in recent years. That's
because they have people who couldn't write musicals.
Right.
Like Andrew Lloyd Webber.
Our nemesis. But it sounds like what comes through in the book is that the musical actually has its roots in spectacle. So it's almost a return. There's spectacle, and then it became something better, and now it's devolving back into something that's...
What is called the first musical, it wasn't a musical. It was what you're calling a spectacle, extravaganza.
Yeah.
A French ballet company came to New York, and where they were supposed to perform burned down. So they went to another theater owner who was about to produce a show called The Black Crook. And apparently he figured it wasn't very good, and he wasn't that nuts about the music. So he put in the ballet as well, because he figured 100 women, which is what it was, in tights, was going to attract
people.
Sell
his tickets, right.
And then along with that, he threw in an extraordinary amount of production values. Opening night was 3.5 hours. Critics hated it. Audiences loved it. It toured around in various versions for the rest of the century.
Wow. Well, what I'm most interested in is what you learned by doing this really comprehensive overview, tracing, you know, step by step the evolution of the form. What do you conclude about what the essence of the form is, or what's important?
The original title of the book was Keeping Up with the Times. And the subtitle was No Legs, No Jokes, No Chance, A History of the American Musical. What I went in, I guess I went in with a premise and set out to prove it. And basically, it's true. The musical had to keep up with the times in terms of the music that was popular at the time, in terms of what audiences wanted to laugh at, what audiences wanted to know about,
mm-hmm.
What kinds of musicals audiences wanted to see. When it didn't or couldn't keep up with the times, it started losing, and people started saying, Broadway is dying.
Uh-huh.
That's been said many, many times. That's why there's a chronology, because every chapter, along with what shows opened during the time covered by that chapter, also includes a chronology of what else happened during that time.
Right.
In terms of history, in terms of politics,
media.
In terms of the media, mm-hmm. in terms of sports, in terms of business, inventions, what came on the market when.
And these are set out as kind of like sidebars in each chapter so that you can just read that and
bottom
get oriented.
Bars.
Bottom bars, whatever that would be, right. So that you get oriented to the era.
Yeah, exactly. Probably the longest fallow time. Well, company changed, made the concept musical a viable form, and people got very interested in it for a while. Cabaret is half concept and half traditional musical. Everything that happens in the cabaret is not part of the musical. It's
mm-hmm.
concept. All the songs in the cabaret are illustrating, in one way or another, the gradual takeover of Nazism. It's a great musical.
Great
musical. And then he did Follies, which, although it was ran for a year and a half, lost a lot of money. It was too big,
mm-hmm.
And too sad. Mm-hmm. It was one of the most down musicals I've ever seen. Almost no hope left. I mean, it could have been by Chekhov.
There's a concept. Three Sisters, the musicalization.
I don't want to see it. Joshua Logan wrote a pre-Civil War Southern version of the cherry orchard called the Wisteria Trees. It's terrible. Musical, but eventually that wore thin. And what started disappearing altogether, and I'm afraid that Sondheim and Prince are largely responsible for this is the musical comedy.
Mm-hmm. It just because they wanted to say something serious.
Yeah, and the musical just started taking itself more and more seriously, so that starting with Evita, which is, I think, the last good Andrew Lloyd Webber musical, because he wrote it with Tim Rice, mm-hmm. spectacle started getting more and more important. And then we got the chandelier falling and the barricade being
built. The helicopter landing
and all that crap. I do not go to a Broadway show to see a chandelier drop.
You know. Well, we'll talk a little bit. I mean, is the musical now really truly dying, or
no,
are we just waiting?
Back.
It's back.
It's back.
All right.
And
what's the sign
of that? Comedy came back
and,
right at the turn of the century. The musical comedy started coming back, most particularly with the producers. Unfortunately, he didn't follow his string with that awful Young Frankenstein musical. That was a bad idea. Why turn that into a musical?
Well, but couldn't you say the same thing about the producers? I mean,
no.
How do you know? This was one of my questions. How do you know what play is worth, or movie is worth, turning into a musical?
The producers was about putting on a show. Mm-hmm. That automatically, if it's, a lot of musicals are set in show business, mm-hmm. one way or another, that automatically seems to lead to more of a possibility of song.
Mm-hmm. Because it's show business people who might sing, or why?
And because there are numbers within the show that are actually performances.
Right. But it's certainly, you can make a great musical without that.
Yeah.
And you can make a really bad one with it.
Oh, it's been done over and over. But that helps. But also, the producers already had three songs in it.
Mm-hmm.
And they found the way to, you have to figure out how it makes sense to move from dialogue to singing.
Right, right.
And you have to work it out so that as a performer, you can make that move. That's one of the hardest things for our students to learn, is how to move from dialogue to song without it seeming like a jump.
Right. I heard Nick Heitner say that he thought that was the main reason that these British through-composed musicals arose, is because you just solved the problem by not doing it. It's a crutch, essentially, to avoid that.
Yeah.
Well, you were talking, though, about how you feel there is a resurgence in the media.
Oh, yeah. Including, they finally figured out how to use rock.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of musicals now have rock scores. The first musical to have rock music in it, and it was a traditional musical with traditional music, but it had a rock singer in it. And it had teenagers in it. It was Bye-Bye Birdie.
Mm-hmm.
The first serious musical was Hair.
Right.
And as I said, it had no...
Nothing followed.
No. Mm-hmm. Only flops. And then they gave up on it.
Mm-hmm.
But, what's that musical about the guys who become strippers?
The Full Monty?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's got a rock score.
Uh-huh.
And the book goes up to Spring Awakening. Spring Awakening is a 19th century German play about repressed society sexually, which can't talk to its children about sex. And the script is almost entirely that play. But the inner thoughts and inner feelings are rock songs. And out of nowhere, they pull up microphones for the songs.
Mm-hmm.
And it works. But for as long as Broadway couldn't keep up with the times musically, and at the same time couldn't keep up with the desire to relax and not take your troubles into the theater with you at $100 a ticket, it got to a point where Broadway simply wasn't keeping up with the times.
Well, you made an interesting point in the book about that pop music in general is not well suited to the musical form, because a really good song in a musical has what you called, and I think you're quoting Sondheim, a three-act structure even within the song.
Yeah.
Is that right? And you also talk about the importance of furthering character, furthering plot through the musical numbers.
And atmosphere. Whereas rock is repetitive.
Right. So now why is rock suddenly working?
Because it's rock beat, but it's lyrics that develop.
Mm-hmm. So it's some kind of melding.
And the music, therefore, develops too.
Mm-hmm.
It's a really good show.
Yeah, yeah. Well, how does it change a theatrical scene not to have something like Broadway? I mean, I think particularly with the recent Tony Awards and for the last 10 years, Chicago is increasingly seeming like a pretty strong competitor to New York as a capital of straight theater. But we don't have anything like the musical theater of Broadway. So how does that change our theater?
There's a group that works out of the theater building called the New Tuners, which develops new musicals.
And there was that project at Northwestern.
Right.
Well, could you see Chicago becoming more important as a...
Only if we start turning out musicals that like that Broadway likes when we send them there.
Mm-hmm. Broadway will always be there.
Have we? Oh, sure. Have we ever sent a musical to Broadway? I can't think of it.
You're in Town? Isn't that a...
Oh, but we sent one to Off-Broadway just recently.
Oh, Adding Machine from Next. Right.
Excuse me. But I would like to point out that David Cromer, who directed Adding Machine and won an Obie as Best Director, and Anna Shapiro, who directed August Osage County and won a Tony as Best Director, are both my students.
Well, I'm glad you said that. Let's talk about Leave the Book for
I'm
Now.
I'm so proud of them.
And you have taught so many directors in this town.
And actors and improvisers.
Right. Right.
That's what I do most, and it's what I love most.
Well, I'm interested about some kind of historical perspective on Chicago theater. What do you see as trends in our scene here? And
now?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Or over time, just what?
Well, first of all, I'm very frightened about something. Along with the enormous success and awards of Adding Machine and August Osage County, and all the publicity that all that got, and
the Chicago Shakespeare getting
and Chicago Shakespeare getting that regional theater award. There was a piece in the New York Times earlier this week. The headline was "One Chicago Show Leaving, One Chicago Show Coming Back, Coming In."
Mm-hmm.
The leaving one is Adding Machine is closing, and coming in is the Theater of Black production of The Strangerer. It was the headline about Chicago theater. Chicago theater, I'm afraid, is getting the kind of publicity where it's going to turn into New York theater in the sense that people are going to come here to get discovered.
Right, right.
That's already true of why people come to Chicago in terms of Second City.
Mm-hmm.
With its thousands of students, all of whom hope to get on the main stage.
Right.
There's a big difference, I find, more often than not, between Chicago acting and New York acting. Mm-hmm. New York acting is more about an awareness of the audience.
Mm-hmm.
Chicago acting is more about being an ensemble.
Yeah, awareness of the people that you're on stage with.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know one of the big differences between New York and Chicago? There is no ensemble award in the Tonys.
Right. Whereas for our Jeffs, that's something we recognize, we care about.
And always have.
Yeah, yeah, that's a good point. We'll talk some more about the Chicago theater scene, other than this fear that we start to become the trying out ground for Hollywood and Broadway.
Well, I saw it happen with Second City.
Yeah, and it becomes a very different culture then.
Yeah. Both the audience and the reason for being there took a change in the 70s. Three things happened within a couple of years of each other. Saturday Night Live, mm-hmm. SCTV, mm-hmm. and Animal House.
Mm-hmm.
And they were all highly publicized as having Second City alumni in them.
Right. So it became a celebrity culture.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, it seems to me that besides that fear, which I understand, because a lot of people talk about how important it is to them, that it's kind of quiet here. It's just about the work. It's not about the celebrity.
As I keep on saying, look, I've been to New York. I've been to Hollywood. I've been to Toronto, which is the Canadian New York and Hollywood.
Mm-hmm.
I've done movies. I've done TV. I'm here because I hated movies, working on movies. I hated working on TV. Mm-hmm. I hated working in the theater in New York.
Mm-hmm.
I felt like if I didn't succeed with this, I'd never get work again.
Yeah.
But more important than that, I had to become a killer. That's the only way to survive.
Wow.
And I started feeling myself becoming that way. I couldn't do it.
And that's not the case in Chicago.
So I came back to Chicago because in Chicago you can do your work, you can experiment, you can fail, and you can continue doing your work.
Right, right.
But also, I like best being at the beginnings of people's careers. That's what I like to do best. I like directing in the smaller storefront theaters like The Gift, where I've done three shows for them now. And I love teaching students. I love teaching. So here I am in the city where I can do all that and work and make a really good living in theater and in the education of theater and feel good about myself.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, tell me what's different about directing students, if anything.
Not much.
Really?
They need more guidance. Mm-hmm. They're mostly less willing to try other stuff.
Mm-hmm. They're more risk averse?
They're less willing to risk being wrong.
They don't want to fall on their faces.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What I keep on saying to them, again, I hope I can say this on...
You can.
Okay. Is you got to take risks. You know, if you fail, so you won't take that risk again. But better an asshole than a chicken shit.
I think we should end on that.
Oh, okay.
You've lived that way, I think, yourself. Well, thank you, Sheldon Patinkin, so much. It's been a great pleasure talking to you.